This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 31st of August, these are our main stories. Ukrainian officials say a Russian aerial attack has killed at least seven people in Kharkiv. Moscow has pulled part of its paramilitary force out of Burkina Faso to help defend Russia's Kursk region from a Ukrainian offensive. Brazil's Supreme Court has ordered the immediate suspension of the social media platform X in the country. Also in this podcast,
we had to launch a rocket and it went up to an altitude of about 760 kilometres and had a suite of instruments on board and they were measuring the electric field.
Finally, proof that the Earth has its own electric field. So what does it do? We begin in Ukraine. Officials in the country's second city, Kharkiv, say at least seven people were killed and dozens hurt on Friday in Russian strikes, including a guided bomb attack. The victims include a teenage girl in a playground and people in a nearby apartment block. Abdujalil Abdurasulov reports from Kyiv.
Each day, residents of Kharkiv can only guess who and what will be Moscow's next target. This time, Russian glide bombs killed residents living in a 12-story apartment block and a 14-year-old girl in a playground. Glide bombs are not as precise as cruise missiles or ballistic rockets. Their purpose is to cause devastation. And this is exactly what the Kremlin wants to achieve, Kyiv says. President Zelensky responded to this attack by once again calling on Ukraine's allies to lift restrictions on the use of long-range weapons to attack Russian territories.
Meanwhile, President Zelensky has dismissed the commander of the Air Force after one of the F-16 fighter jets donated by its NATO allies crashed on Monday. The pilot of the plane was killed. The F-16 was being used during an operation to repel Russian missile attacks. The cause of the crash is unknown. In a video message, Mr. Zelensky said he made the decision to replace Mykola Oleshchuk in order to strengthen his country's military leadership.
I've decided to replace the commander of the Air Force of Ukraine. I'm immensely grateful to all our pilots, engineers and all our air defence personnel. To everyone who's truly fighting for Ukraine, for results. And this is just as necessary at the command level. We must strengthen ourselves and protect our people, protect the personnel, protect all our warriors.
Well, the pilot killed in the incident was named as Alexei Mes, with the call sign Moonfish. He was one of the first few Ukrainian pilots trained to fly advanced fighter jets. Ben Brown spoke to Adam Makos, co-founder of the Wingman for Ukraine campaign group, who worked alongside the pilot. So what does he know about the crash?
That morning, Russia had launched one of its largest aerial attacks, flinging cruise missiles and Shahed drones at Kyiv and other places. And so around 7 o'clock in the morning, this attack took place. Moonfish was up there shooting down these things. It is believed that he shot down three Russian cruise missiles, as well as one of the Iranian-built drones, the Shaheds, which has been very difficult to do to date. With a prior aircraft that Ukraine was using, the MiG-29s and Su-27s, the old Soviet stuff, they weren't able to do it at this level. So he knocked down four air-to-air victories in that mission. And a week before, he had knocked down another Shahed. So technically, this young man, on the day of his death, he became an ace.
It's very early days to speculate, but President Zelensky sacking the commander of the Ukrainian Air Force, you wonder why?
It's such a catastrophic loss in so many ways because he was such a fine human being. He was, of course, the leader of the F-16 squadron that had been trained overseas and brought into Ukraine. And so of all the guys, that's really, I think, the hardest part to take. Why Moonfish? Moonfish had trained in 2019 with the California Air National Guard. So he spoke excellent English. He had flown with American pilots. And then he undertook this incredible mission. He was trying to get the message out to the Western world that they needed these modern jets. And I had told him and his friend Juice, these two MiG-29 pilots, I said, guys, you've got to come to Washington if you're to do that. You've got to look them in the eyes. And so Moonfish and Juice left the front lines. They flew to Washington, D.C., and we put them in front of eight of the most powerful U.S. senators. And these young men went in there and they made their case. And it's an incredible story because as soon as they walked in, one of the firebrands said to them, you guys have come a long way, but you know you're not getting F-16s. And that would rattle a lot of people. But Moonfish and Juice, they hung in there. and they made their case. And by the time that meeting was over, that same senator, when he pulled up to them when they were leaving, he lowered the window of his car and he said, "God bless you guys. I know you're going back into combat next week, and we're going to have something for you." A year later, the F-16s came to Ukraine.
How important are the F-16s to Ukraine?
Well, I think we saw on August 26th what Oleksiy was doing, what Moonfish was doing. He was saving the civilians on the ground. Every missile he shot down, every drone, was some little kid who was not going to wake up with rubble over him or lose his parents. I mean, he was fighting for his people. And so it's a tragedy, but he went out a hero, and I think people will always remember him for that.
That was Adam Makos, the head of a Russian paramilitary force deployed to Burkina Faso, says troops have been pulled out of the country in order to defend Russia's Kursk region. This follows an incursion there by Ukrainian forces. In May, the so-called Bear Brigade, which is linked to Russia's defense ministry, was deployed to Burkina Faso, which is under threat from Islamist militants. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told me more about the Russian group and its activities.
Nothing is ever made official, but what we understand is they were part of a group of several hundred Russian paramilitary forces who were there to help in the fight against the Islamist militants. But from some of the information that's been posted by this Bear group, they seem to spend some of their time protecting the military ruler of the country, Colonel Ibrahim Traore, and perhaps not so much time fighting the jihadists. That there has been this partial withdrawal, but we understand probably at least 200 Russian troops are still in the country. But this seems to be all of what was called the Bear Brigade leaving. But the troops who used to be under what was known as the Wagner Group and then became African Corps are still there. But all of these Russian troops, we understand, are kind of under the supervision of the Ministry of Defence in Moscow.
Given the fact that a few days ago there was one of the worst Islamist attacks in recent months in Burkina Faso, the fact that now there are 200 Russians going to be leaving, it puts the country in even more perilous situation, doesn't it?
It does, and I think it's a worrying time for Captain Ibrahim Traore, who took power. I mean, he has just cancelled a trip to China that he was due to go on, perhaps a sign that he's possibly a bit worried about his position at home. There have been these terrible attacks by Islamist militants in recent days, including one last weekend. The authorities haven't said officially how many people died, but locals are talking about more than 300 people being killed in the north of the country. So not only could it personally be a problem for the military ruler, who may not have the close protection he had before, but also the fact that there are less troops on the ground to help in the fight, in theory, against these Islamist militants, could make things more difficult, because it seems to be kind of becoming a bit untenable, the fact he seized power 2 years ago saying, you know, I'm going to make the country safer, and it's got worse.
Will Ross. Now to the Middle East. In the West Bank, Israel's military operation is continuing, with the army saying it killed a Hamas commander on Friday. The fighting has attracted criticism from the UN and a number of countries. On Thursday, the Israeli military withdrew from a refugee camp near the city of Tulkarm. It says it killed five people, including the local head of Islamic Jihad. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has now made it to the camp and sent this report.
It wasn't easy carrying Ayed Abu Hajja's body through Nur Sham's refugee camp today. His mother's house sits in an area scarred by demolition and destruction after a two-day incursion by Israel's army. From there, they carried Ayed to the cemetery, a 69-year-old man with a disability, shot by a sniper, neighbours said, when he opened a window in his house during the operation. At the cemetery, groups of young men fired automatic weapons in a separate ceremony to honour another man killed during Israel's operation, Mohammed Jabba, the local leader of Tulkarm's armed Palestinian groups. The bursts of gunfire, a show of force from fighters here, less than a day after Israel's army withdrew. Walking back through the camp, we pass Fadwa Abu Ayad, the remains of her neighbour's house blocking her path to the street with a huge pile of rubble.
They told us that we have tunnels and we smuggle the armed groups to this house. It is impossible. He claimed that we have tunnels like those in Gaza. He brought a drill and dug into the floor, and all he found was a sewer manhole.
Fadwa takes us through another entrance to her house and shows us the broken floor. Beneath it, a small pipe and what appears to be a sewer drain, too small for a person to fit through.
As Gaza, this is Gaza, small Gaza. Camps here, small Gaza.
She says the conflict in the refugee camps here feels like a little Gaza. It's something you hear a lot here now. The Gaza war is on a different scale to this conflict, but it's changed attitudes and tactics on both sides. Israel's army pulled out of Tulkarm, but its operation in the city of Jenin further north seems to be intensifying. Three men were reportedly killed by the army east of the city. Israel said they included a local leader of Hamas. Bursts of gunfire have begun again tonight in Jenin, and there's loud and constant buzzing of military drones overhead. An Israeli commander involved in the operations here said that terror organizations had taken over refugee camps in the northern West Bank and that the army would prevent them from damaging Israel, however long it takes.
Lucy Williamson in the West Bank. Next to Brazil, where X, one of the country's most popular social media platforms, formerly known as Twitter, was suspended on Friday. The move was ordered by the Brazilian Supreme Court. It's the culmination of months of tension between the authorities in Brazil and Elon Musk, the owner of X. Mr. Musk has attacked what he called the pseudo-judge. Luis Fajardo is our correspondent in the region. He told me what the ruling means in practice.
The Supreme Court magistrate, Moraes, has ordered the Brazilian telecommunications agency to suspend access to X across Brazilian territory within 24 hours. They have also said that anyone trying to access X through other measures, for example, VPNs, other technological means to try to access the platform, would also get severe fines. So it does seem to be a very serious measure to suspend the activities of X across all of Brazil.
And talk us why the Supreme Court judge has made this order.
Well, X had refused a previous order by the Brazilian judiciary to appoint a legal representative in the company. This is because X said that if their employee in Brazil could be subject to other kinds of legal penalties. And the origin of the dispute is in the decisions by the judiciary ordering X to suspend accounts which were said to be distributing disinformation, false information. Many of these accounts were associated with followers of the former right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro. And X had been maintaining a dispute with Brazilian authorities about these orders to suspend them. And they also had fines to pay because of their initial refusal to suspend these accounts. During the course of the last few days, also Elon Musk, the owner of X, had become involved in this dispute. Very strong words being sent from Musk to Brazilian authorities as the dispute escalated in the last few hours.
Now, Elon Musk has said this has happened simply because we would not comply with the judge's illegal orders to censor his political opponents. Meanwhile, the president of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, has said, look, any citizen from anywhere in the world who has investments in Brazil is subject to the Brazilian laws. Who does Musk think he is? So those are the two dividing lines. What do Brazilians think about all this?
Brazil is a very, very politically polarized country. Of course, a substantial part of the population sympathizes with Bolsonaro. Nearly half the population voted for him in the last election in which he lost. So a lot of people will sympathize with the arguments of Elon Musk saying that these accounts should not be restricted or suspended. This is, of course, a discussion that has been also experimented in several other countries with political leaders and their followers sending very questionable messages across social media. But on the other hand, many Brazilians, of course, will support this decision. They will say that Elon Musk is apparently unwilling to accept the decisions of the Brazilian institutions, and in that sense, they should face the consequences.
Luis Fajardo there. It's being billed as a major scientific discovery, a new electric field that is as fundamental to Earth as gravity. A team from NASA describes the planet-wide field as a great invisible force that lifts up the sky and is responsible for the polar winds. Well, these winds interact with the fast-flowing high air currents known as jet streams to help drive the majority of weather patterns across the globe. Susie Imber is a professor of planetary science here in the UK. She was part of the team who made the discovery, and she's been talking to Johnny Diamond.
In order to measure this ambipolar electric field and to get its profile with altitude, we had to launch a rocket that we launched from Svalbard, and it went up to an altitude of about 760 kilometres. So it went pretty high and had a suite of instruments on board, and they were measuring the electric field as the rocket went up in height. So this is the first time that we've been able to make a direct measurement of this field.
When you had confirmation that this field existed, was that kind of, okay, tick, we knew that was around and now we've had it confirmed? Or was it, wow, we have actually finally shown this exists?
Given that we had observed it on other planets, we had an expectation that it would be there. And given that we had observed the result of it, this cold population of escaping ions, we also believed it was highly likely it would be there. But to measure it and to measure it accurately using our rockets gave us some parameters that we didn't have before. So there had been some estimations that had been made before of the magnitude of this field, but we didn't have an answer for what it looked like. And we certainly didn't quite understand how the electric field varied with altitude. So to do this for the first time is actually quite a big step forward.
I need to ask you a question that I'm not sure you have an answer for, which is what this field tells us about what the Earth is and how the Earth has developed. Do you know any of that as yet?
We don't know any of that. So this is just the beginning, really, in trying to understand how this atmospheric escape process might have changed and influenced the developments of the atmosphere on the Earth. We hope that colleagues working in that area will take the result that we have and use that to influence more research in this area.
Planetary scientist Susie Imber. Still to come. Can monkeys like these really call each other by name? Awareness about sexual health has been on a roughly upward trajectory since the start of the HIV epidemic in the 1980s. And since then, the more widespread use of condoms around the world has reduced the spread of sexually transmitted diseases and unplanned pregnancies in some parts of the world. But now the World Health Organization says one age group, teenagers, are showing an alarming lack of interest in using them. Alfie Habershed reports.
It doesn't seem to matter where you are in the world. The trend is consistent. Fewer teenagers are using condoms when having sex. An international survey of a quarter of a million 15-year-olds says almost 10% fewer boys are using them compared to 2014. And that means that in places like the UK, the Netherlands and Sweden, they are only used about half of the time. The World Health Organization says this is alarming but not surprising. It says in many countries, sex education has recently come under attack on the misunderstanding that it encourages sexual behaviour. The WHO also points to the closure of schools during COVID that meant young people missed out on learning about protection. But others suggest it's a bit more complicated than that.
I just have to talk about this with you.
Ladies, let's talk about hormone-free birth control.
Hormone-free birth control.
Hormone-free birth control.
Because while classrooms may be quiet and subdued, the conversation about protection on TikTok is loud and unfiltered. And Dr. Paula Briggs, a sexual health consultant here in the UK, says this may be driving new attitudes.
People are exposed to misinformation on social media, and the focus is very negative around hormonal contraception. There are loads of myths in relation to sexual health, and one of those is that you can't get pregnant the first time you have sex. Well, you know, that's just not true, and I think we just need to be very transparent with young people.
The WHO says more research needs to be done to understand this worrying trend and how to turn it around, but that it's clear urgent action needs to be taken.
That report by Alfie Habershed. Next to Spain, and the capital Madrid lies on a high plateau. It gets very cold in the winter and unbearably hot in the summer. Trees provide much needed shade on the hottest days, but the local authorities have been removing them from many areas in order to make way for renovation and development projects. And that has prompted strong opposition from locals, as Guy Hedgecoe reports from Madrid.
Protesters chant against the removal of trees from the emblematic Plaza Santa Ana in central Madrid earlier this summer. This square has been part of a dispute between activists and local authorities. Under a city hall plan, almost all the square's trees would be felled or moved elsewhere in order to allow work on an underground car park. I'm in Santa Ana Square, where that protest took place. And looking at the far end of the square, I can see a statue of the poet Federico García Lorca. But much of the square is taken up by cafes, which have tables and chairs out under parasols. There's several dozen trees here, which include cypresses, chestnut trees, and some very tall plane trees. Lola Méndez is a local activist who has been protesting against the plan to remove the trees.
I'm very angry and very sad at how our local authorities refuse to take into account the wishes of residents. These are our trees. In a city which is becoming hotter and hotter, these are our haven from the heat, where people can interact.
The conservative mayor of Madrid, José Luis Almeida Martínez, has played down the controversy.
People are fond of these trees, but I'm confident that the work which is underway will have a limited impact on them. And the people of Madrid can be sure that we will replant the trees elsewhere.
But this is just one of several sites in Madrid where the removal of trees to make way for development or renovation projects has caused a backlash. Activists say 36,000 trees have been lost since Mr. Almeida Martínez took office in 2019, and that replanting initiatives have often failed. Luciano Lavajos is a horticulturalist with the organisation Environmentalists in Action.
Las ciudades mediterráneas como Madrid tienen un importante problema.
Mediterranean cities like Madrid have a big problem, which has got worse in recent years and is going to get even worse. And that is the extreme temperatures we have in the summer. One of the most important roles of trees in cities is to lower temperatures and increase humidity.
I'm back in the Plaza Santa Ana, taking refuge in the shade of a chestnut tree as the temperature starts to soar here. There has been some good news recently for those who've been protesting, because the removal of trees from this square has been put on hold, at least temporarily, because of the protests. So we'll have to wait for a final decision on the future of these trees, which for some are getting in the way of building work, but which for others provide badly needed respite from the Spanish sun.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. The end of August means only one thing if you're a football fan. The end of the summer transfer window. It closed on Friday in many of Europe's big leagues. It was the last chance that teams had to buy new players until January. Traditionally, millions of dollars have changed hands in the English Premier League alone as the deadline approached. Minutes after that deadline passed, I spoke to our sports reporter Paul Serres.
The two big deals that I'm talking about that we believe, that BBC Sport believes, are in the offing are Raheem Sterling joining Arsenal from Chelsea and Jadon Sancho joining Chelsea from Manchester United. These are two players that are out of favour with their current clubs, but are on very big deals and are likely or were likely to stay where they were despite not getting the kind of game time that they want from their respective managers. It looks like that's all about to change. Jadon Sancho is a childhood Chelsea supporter. United paid an awful lot of money for him from Borussia Dortmund a few years ago. It hasn't worked for him. Maybe, just maybe, a move to his childhood club, Chelsea, will reinvigorate his career. He's still very young. We're waiting for confirmation of that. United have been busy in the transfer window today. They, from Paris Saint-Germain, have signed the Uruguayan international midfielder Manuel Ugarte, who the United boss Erik ten Hag has said is one of the best in the world in his position. They've let Scott McTominay go. He's gone to Napoli, and to Antonio Conte, the former Chelsea manager in charge there. Billy Gilmore has gone also to Napoli from Brighton. Wilfried Zaha, the Ivorian international winger who spent last year at Galatasaray in Istanbul, he's gone to Lyon in France on a season-long loan deal. Neto, the Brazilian goalkeeper, has joined Arsenal, and all sorts of things have been going on today. They're still going on now. Frank Onyeka, the Nigerian, has left Brentford. He's gone to Germany to Augsburg. Maxence Lacroix has left Germany for England and Crystal Palace, and there's all sorts still in the offing. Maybe one of the bigger deals of the day, not necessarily in terms of the finances, but Fulham have, they are at least in negotiations with third-tier Birmingham City to sell one of their young forwards.
That was Paul Sarris. So how does the transfer process work? One man who knows is Kees Vos, head of the Sports Entertainment Group, or SEG. He's an agent for the likes of Liverpool star Cody Gakpo and the Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag. Matt Lyons has more.
He set up SEG in 2000 with a childhood friend, Alex Kroos. It now boasts more than 600 clients, from players Rasmus Højlund, Cody Gakpo, to coaches Erik ten Hag, Pep Guardiola. In fact, it's been claimed he's the man controlling the ins and outs at Manchester United right now. He's got fingers in lots of pies, with SEG now having clients in cycling, esports and music. But what I wanted to know is how the football transfer window works from the inside.
It's all day by day. Of course, you try to prepare as much as you can. But one hand, we represent talent. So then we try to do career planning with them. That goes from 17-year-old players to experienced pros. So that's an ongoing process which goes out throughout the year, I think. And then on the other side, we have clients which are clubs, you know. So that we are hired by clubs to help them renovate their squads.
Let's talk about getting a deal done then. What are the key things to making sure that parties agree?
You have to understand that if a transfer is made, there's three parties involved. There's a buying club, there's a selling club, and there's a player. And everybody is looking for the optimum for themselves. You know, the buying club wants to pay as less as possible, and the selling club wants to receive as much as possible. And the player wants to get the best deal or the best club out of it. And maybe if two clubs are in agreement, the player doesn't even want to go to that club. That's a possibility. If I go back 20 years, then you were managing a player, or you were the agent to a player. The only point of contact was the player, and then maybe his wife. And nowadays, it's way more than that. It's fathers, mothers, uncles, nephews, brothers, sisters. But then there's also, people they trust. It could be a financial advisor, it could be a next-door neighbor they knew from way before. It's a sexy business. It's appealing, so it appeals also to the people around a player.
So if that's how you get a deal done, what transfer is Kees most proud he got over the line?
I've done many, many deals, but I think the one of Robin van Persie from Arsenal to Manchester United is one that really stands out.
Another new season, another new signing. Manchester United's capture of Robin van Persie from Arsenal, a timely reminder of why the Premier League remains so popular. Big money, big names, and fleeting loyalty.
It was a deal between two clubs back then who didn't want to deal with each other. It was back then when Wenger was in Arsenal and Sir Alex Ferguson was running Manchester United. So it was not very likely that Robin would go to that club. To get that done was something I'm proud of. Yeah, I think it was a very good result.
And what then of a more recent high-profile deal that was secured?
All the talk going into the FA Cup final last month was that Manchester United manager Erik ten Hag was going to lose his job, whatever happened. Well, what happened was they won, and now 2.5 weeks on, he's staying in charge.
Manchester United have extended the contract of manager Erik ten Hag until June 2026.
Was he pleased when that was done?
If they're happy, I'm happy. If they don't want to continue with each other, then I'm also happy. It doesn't matter. You know, I'm not the one who makes a decision. You know, if a player moves or stays at a club, it doesn't matter for me. If he's happy to stay, then we're happy that he's happy. And in this particular case, there was a lot of speculation about it, but in the end, everybody decided that it was the right fit. So then I'm happy.
The football agent, Case Voss, who was speaking to Matt Lyons. Marmosets are tiny tree-dwelling monkeys from South America. They're shy little things with white locks of hair that sprout from the side of their heads. But it appears they have a special talent. Scientists have discovered that these primates actually use names for each other. This report from Wendy Urquhart.
That might sound like birds, but it's actually marmoset monkeys having a chat in the rainforest in South America. They're only 8 centimetres long, feed on insects, fruit, sap and gum, and these super cute little bundles of fur are native to Bolivia, Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, Paraguay and Peru. David Omer from Hebrew University in Jerusalem is the lead author of a new study that's found that the high-pitched squeaks they use, or fecals, are how they communicate and that they use different names for each other.
The experiment took place in such a way that we took a pair of monkeys together so they knew who is the other monkey before we placed the visual barrier. The interesting thing is that when we analyzed the calls, we saw that there was a very strategic pattern of behavior for all of the monkeys, and during the first call exchange, it seems like a monkey was trying different names of different monkeys, and after about 20 calls, they sort of converge to the correct call for the other monkey on the other side and stick to it.
Marmosets are the only primates to use names for each other, which is really useful in the rainforest. Not only can they let each other know where they are, they also know who they're talking to and can call for help if they need to.
For them, social cohesion is extremely important for survival. And this naming behavior probably helps to keep the family in a cohesive structure in the jungle.
Scientists are hoping that future studies will help them discover the process by which the monkeys learn how to name each other.
Wendy Urquhart. And that's all for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Tom Bartlett. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.